then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin, eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. There beside the singing river, the dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune, and hurrah, my boys, for freedom. 'Tis the rising of the moon, 'tis the rising of the moon, 'tis the rising of the moon, and hurrah, my boys, for freedom. 'Tis the rising of the moon. Well, they fought for poor old Ireland, and full bitter was their fate. Oh, what glorious pride of sorrow filled the name of 98. Yet, thank God, it still is beating heart in manhood's burning noon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's February the 17th, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, as I mentioned during the last show, from now on we'll take the questions and discussion topics first. We'll have a musical break or two, and then I'll close out with a monologue or rant, however you want to describe it. I'm sorry that yet again, last time I wasn't able to give you guys a whole hour, but the fact is that my voice just plain seems to run out after 45 minutes of talking. I suppose it's like any other faculty, you have to exercise in order to acquire strength and stamina. Now, the first question comes, I think, from Hewitt in Oklahoma, but to be honest, guys, that ruthless Nazi efficiency, which once made us the terror of the civilized world, has struck again. And when I was cutting and pasting this question into my raw data Word file, I seem to have lost the signature to this email, so I think this is Hewitt's question. But if it's somebody else's, I do apologize. Anyway, the email runs as follows. Dear HAC, love last week's Wardruna music selection. I think I've made mention of this before, but I'm curious about your sentiments regarding the forming of enclaves versus randomly moving to such a vast area and likely not being surrounded by the kinfolk one desires to come home to. I also think a yearly festival would be a good idea to ponder, i.e. Northwest Fest. It would be an event for those already home to make the acquaintance of others in the community, as well as an opportunity for considering making the move. Okay, that's a two-parter, and I'll try to hit both of those topics and not ramble too badly off course. Just as the Northwest idea is not original with me and has been around for almost 40 years now, so is the idea of establishing small, local white enclaves rather than a whole new white nation, a concept that's been around for quite a while. On the Internet, this idea is best expressed in what's called the Pioneer Little Europe, or PLE. The basic idea here is that since there are tens of thousands and indeed hundreds of thousands of white nationalists, depending on how broad your definition of white nationalism is, the question is this: what if we could get all of us to move to some little town or medium-sized city like Peoria, Illinois, which is Matt Hale's idea, or some rural county in the Northwest that's very sparsely populated, and then we get everybody registered to vote, and we take over the local government. We get our own sheriff, who hires only white nationalist deputies. We get our own mayor and county commissioners and our own dog catcher, so forth and so on, thereby creating our own white enclave or reservation or Bantustan, whatever you want to call it. After all, this has been done before in this country. The Rajneesh cult took over a small town here in Oregon for a couple of years in the 1980s by bringing in thousands of cult members to live in their commune and outvoting the locals. And the Scientologists have done the same thing in some small town in Florida, whose name escapes me at the moment, and I believe voted in their own city council, which, for all I know, may still be the case. And granted, all of this sounds very logical and convincing on the Internet. Like everything else to do with us, it's when we try to take it off the Internet and into the real world that the problems start cropping up. And when you look a little closer, there are a lot of problems with this PLE concept, both practical and ideological problems. We'll deal with the practical ones first. The first practical difficulty which emerges with the PLE idea is that, well, it's the same perennial problem all of white nationalism has, that of character. The perennial disconnect between what is said and what is done. This weird idea we have that to articulate a problem is to solve it. The complete lack of any connection in our own minds between what we say on the Internet and what we do in our real-world lives. We're not weirded-out cult members, and we simply don't have the kind of brainwashed discipline to pack up and move whenever and wherever some guru tells us to, would it were so. With white people, us and the libertarians and the Christian fundamentalists, everybody wants to talk about it on the Internet, and nobody wants to actually do it. We're waiting for somebody else to give us permission. We're waiting for somebody else to go first, just like with the Northwest. And it's not just us. The libertarians are running into the same problem with their New Hampshire migration, and the Christian fundamentalists are running into it with their South Carolina migration. They've gotten, to my knowledge, maybe a dozen families each actually to make the move, and their assets, resources, and communications are far better than ours. We all have the same situation, the poor character, apathy, and lack of seriousness of the white population, who are basically consumer animals, 20th century economic units of production and consumption. They don't want to move anywhere. They want to go to the mall. They want all their problems solved in place by some magical, fearless leader so that they don't have to exert any effort or take any risk. Now, that's how certain fearless leaders make a living off the movement. They promise white people that these terrible problems can be solved without blood and sweat and tears, and above all, without packing a moving van. And white people desperately, desperately want to believe them, which is why I have as much difficulty as I do getting through to people. I don't tell white people what they want to hear, and I get stoned for it. We come up with these brilliant ideas on the Internet, we talk it to death, and then when it comes time for somebody to give up their precious leisure time off work to get behind the wheel of their car and do some long-distance driving, to meet people in the flesh, or to open their checkbook and write a man-sized check with some serious zeros on it, all of a sudden we become frightened, we lose interest, and we start wandering away, surfing the net for some other form of entertainment. Yes, you don't need to remind me that there are honorable exceptions to this, more and more of them. And slowly but surely, we are identifying these people, contacting them, and getting them all ginned up to make the move. But this process is way, way too slow. And I'm really worried that events will overtake us while we're waiting for whites to make up their minds. There are an abundance of internet rumors about mysterious PLEs that are supposedly being set up here and there and everywhere. As nearly as I can determine, and I may be wrong, but I've done my best to track some of these stories down, and none of this seems actually to be happening except in a small way here in the Northwest. It seems to be one of our neurotic ways of dealing with the fact that none of us are actually really doing doodly squat, that we make up these stories about all kinds of secret activity and revolutionary happenings that the Jew media is suppressing, of course. But none of it's actually happening. the few times that anyone even vaguely white and racial has actually done anything physical and in the real world, we see how the media reacts in real life. They don't suppress it. They descend like a cloud of shrieking vampire bats on whatever hapless group of white boys happens to have screwed up and actually done something. Ask April Gaddy. She just got hit with a media feeding frenzy because she tried to set up a white dating service, and now she's got the reptiles from the Fourth Estate slobbering all over her. And besides, as far as mysterious and secret PLEs go, I simply don't believe that we're capable of keeping a secret like that. There's no secret PLEs out there except for our own tiny primary settlement areas here in the Northwest. The closest thing I've ever heard to someone actually trying to do it is two things. First off, in South Africa, the Afrikaners are trying to create an all-white area in the Orange Free State called Orania, with very little success because they so foolishly handed state power over to the Kaffirs. And here in this country, back in the late 90s, there was a kind of a real estate development scheme called Almost Heaven in some rural county in Idaho that was being run by Bo Greitz and a couple of conservative suit types with the blow-dried hairdos like televangelists. They were able to buy up some really cheap land and parcel it up into home lots. I'm not sure where, but if it was that cheap, it was probably way, way out in the back of the beyond. I think a few people may actually have bought these lots, but whether any of them actually moved out there, I never heard. I don't know. Maybe there is a little community out there somewhere. I do know that there are small groups of Christian identity people in certain small towns in Idaho, maybe half a dozen families or so apiece, but I don't know if you could call that a PLE. So that's the main problem with enclaves or PLE. Nobody except the Northwest Front is actually doing it in any serious way, so we have no idea yet how it would work in practice, but there are also some larger practical problems. In order for the creation of a PLE to be successful, there would have to be a lot of public activity and internet buzz and whatnot to attract people. It couldn't be done secretly, and not just because our people aren't capable of keeping a secret, but eventually, one way or the other, what we were doing would be discovered by some real estate agent or local reporters or something, and that would tip off the government and the ADL and the SPLC and whatnot. Now, one of the naysays that people who don't really want to do anything at all keep coming up with about the Northwest migration is this idea that if we concentrate all our eggs in one basket, so to speak, then it would be easier for the enemy to concentrate their own force against us and destroy us. Now, I could, of course, point out what wonderful success we've been having over the past 15 years by hiding from one another behind our computers, but there is, in fact, something to that objection if we pick an area so small that the kikes and their gun thugs can surround us. Now, this is one of the main objections to setting up a homeland in an area like New England, which is so small that the existing United States military can surround it and occupy it, something these Vermont secessionists and New Hampshire libertarians can't seem to wrap their minds around. This is also one of the main arguments against those compounds that a lot of us seem to want to hole up in. Ask the Montana Freemen and the Branch Davidians how well that worked out for them. What we're supposed to do when the FBI and the National Guard surround our compound, I don't know, you know, should we run out waving a piece of paper in the air and yelling, "This is my property, I've got the deed!" Ask Ed and Lorraine Brown how well that worked out for them. In the long run, the problem with enclaves in general is that they would be too small to survive on their own, and they would necessarily be surrounded by hostile territory. They would be very difficult to keep supplied with the necessities of life, which they'd have to import from somewhere else, since the land space and possibly the airspace surrounding the enclave would be controlled by the Americans or by other hostiles, the Aztlan, Mexicans, or whatever situation might arise in years to come. Look at what the Israelis are doing to Gaza and the West Bank, even as we speak, and you'll see the problem with enclaves surrounded by superior military force. Do you want your children living like the children of Gaza are forced to exist? I know I've said that we're talking about a Soviet-style collapse, but we don't know yet for sure precisely how the dissolution of the United States is going to come about. Bit by bit, one big huge collapse. How much military force will the United States still command? Will the military mutiny? Will they just sell their weapons for food and wander away like a lot of the Soviet military in Eastern Europe did in the 1990s? Will they transfer their allegiance to smaller states and entities that can actually pay them, like the Soviet military did? We just don't know these things yet. If the Zionist regime in Washington, D.C. remains in even partial power, then some small white enclave attempting to secede would be surrounded by a bitterly hostile enemy and would eventually be overrun and destroyed. This is one of the reasons I think the Protestants of Northern Ireland have never tried to secede, no matter how many times the British government tries to sell them down the river. Ulster is simply too small, and it wouldn't be viable as an independent state. Too small for a republic and too large for a madhouse, as someone once said. A new white nation in North America needs to possess certain geographic, demographic, and economic assets in order to be viable. We need a lot of geography. There would have to be a lot of room to grow into, since we'll be taking in the remnants of white populations from the world over. The Northwest is so big that the United States simply cannot occupy all of it. They can't put a soldier or a cop behind every Douglas fir. A new nation would need a coastline with deep water harbors so that all access to the country would not rely on overflying or overland travel through hostile territory. There will have to be some kind of navy to resist blockade. Imagine what would happen if the wretched inhabitants of the enclave of Gaza were strong enough and had a navy and an air force to break the Israeli blockade. There would have to be mineral resources, sufficient arable and pasture land to grow our own food, and a sufficient infrastructure in manufacturing, energy, transportation, and so forth, so that the new nation would have a chance to survive and prosper and take in the millions of white people who will eventually flee to the homeland from the ends of the earth, which are still controlled by the Zionists and the liberals. The Northwest has all these things. No other contiguous part of the continent does. Now, I understand that most of these quibbles and naysays that so-called white nationalists put up about the Northwest are simply the excuses of people who have no intention of ever doing anything at all, and so I disregard them. The people who do all this negative nattering on the internet are basically useless to us to begin with, because they're useless to everybody. What you have to understand is that a lot of the opposition to the Northwest migration that appears to exist from within the movement isn't really legitimate, because it's not sincere. They're not objecting to the Northwest in particular. They're just fighting against any effort to make them do anything at all except sit behind their computers and moan. White nationalists are really top-notch at finding valid and persuasive and perfectly reasonable causes to do nothing. Now do you see what I mean about my tendency to wander off the subject when I'm answering these questions? Okay, let's move on to part two of Kiewit's question. The proposed annual Northwest Fest. Seems to me that I got into this once before in an earlier podcast, but then maybe my senile memory is playing tricks on me, so I'll be glad to go over it again. Basically, Hewitt, what you're describing is the old Aryan Nations get-togethers that used to take place up at Hayden Lake, Idaho, when Pastor Butler was still alive. Now, some of you listening to this may well have attended some of those meetings, and yeah, they were usually a good time had by all. There were hot dogs and speeches and socializing and tons of gossip. Every little group with five or six guys was there, everybody wearing their own little costume. There was a big meeting hall where speakers from all over the country and the world made inspirational orations, and some of them were pretty good. And you could actually socialize with your own kind for a while, as well as a lot of the other kind. Maybe now is a good time to get into a topic I've been meaning to address, and that is this allegation that Harold just quote-unquote attacks everybody in the movement, meaning that I subject movement events and personalities to critical analysis, and I point out that some of our favorite emperors have no clothes. People, the one thing that distinguishes our movement more than anything else is almost 70 years of unremitting failure. We are now out of time. If we are at all serious about securing the existence of our people and a future for white children, which I sometimes doubt, but if we are, then we have to start the main event now or not at all. Other than Northwest migration and independence, we haven't got anything resembling a plan. We're not going to have any other plan because nothing else is even remotely doable. And it's time for all of us with two brain cells to rub together to stop screwing around and get behind the Northwest imperative. I am trying to work you guys listening to this up to that point, to screw your courage to the sticking point, as Shakespeare put it, so that you can begin a process of moral and spiritual awakening that will cause the scales to fall from your eyes and persuade you to act. And the first thing that has to be done in order to make that happen is for us to do the old Alcoholics Anonymous trick and make a fearless and searching moral inventory of ourselves. You can't get to where you're going if you don't know where you've been. In order to succeed, our movement has to be based above all on truth. And that starts with admitting the truth to ourselves. The best definition of stupidity is doing the same thing over and over again, and yet each time expecting different results. And for almost 6 decades now, that's what the white nationalist movement has been doing. Now, I yield to no man in my respect and my admiration for the late Pastor Richard Butler. And unlike many of you, most likely unlike most of you, I met Butler and I knew him personally, although not closely. But he made mistakes, especially in his later years, and one of those mistakes was to have those big gatherings at Hayden Lake where pretty much anybody with a pale skin could simply walk in the door. At most of those Hayden Lake events, I'd say that easily 1 person in 5 was either an undercover cop of some kind, an undercover reporter who was out to expose all us nasty, wicked racists, a spy for one of these unofficial secret police agencies like the ADL or the Center for Democratic Renewal or the Southern Poverty Law Center, or else, let's be honest now, a just plain coup. One of my movement mentors, the late Pamela Emmerich, who had to be the original little old right-wing lady in tennis shoes, once explained it to me very simply. She said, "These people who cause all the sound and fury in the movement are almost never Jews or police agents or feds or spies of any kind. It's a lot simpler and sadder than that. They're just trouble. They try to drag others into their scene, and in this day and age, and in this deranged and dysfunctional society, that scene is often something pretty weird and scary, like Bo Greitz getting involved in one of his female members' child custody battle, and kooks who wanted him to talk about alien visitors during his presidential campaign, and no, I don't mean the Mexican kind. Let's be honest, people, because we no longer dare to be anything else. If you open up a picnic ground or a compound, or call a meeting in a public place, and let just anybody with a pale skin boogie on in, that one way or another you're going to have trouble, and we've got 50 years of experience in this kind of thing to prove it. It's no longer enough to simply moan about how, oh, we never seem to learn. We have to start learning, people. Now, public events like that draw cops and spies and loons like honey draws flies, and although we can debate on how the final balance sheet turned out, I don't think anyone at all knowledgeable would deny that at least some of the good that was done at Hayden Lake was counterbalanced and undone by the harm that these people caused, of which the most obvious example was what was done to Randy Weaver and his family. Randy came down from Ruby Ridge and attended a few of those Hayden Lake gatherings, and when the FBI picked up on it, they tried to flip him as an informer, and when he refused, they framed him and then murdered his wife and son. I know of at least one other case where a man made the mistake of attending one of those Aryan fests. He allowed himself to be photographed. The photograph turned up in the local newspaper, and when he ended up in divorce court, his wife used that picture to take his children and destroy his family. Folks, Americans aren't like Europeans. We're very new hands at all this revolutionary stuff. Revolution has only been attempted twice in this country's history, once unsuccessfully, and we don't have the tradition of underground resistance movements that our comrades in Europe have, from the IRA to the Ustashi to the Samizdat Writers of the Soviet Union. We still have a lot to learn, and we seem to be slow learners. A revolution is not a tea party in any sense of the term. A revolutionary party is not a rotary club, and it can't be run like one. The Northwest Front is in the early stages now, and we are having some meetings, but we have a strict rule that no one shows up at one until he has been personally met and checked out by myself or one of our senior comrades, and that includes as much of a serious background check as we have the resources to make at this point. Our vetting system is still very crude and probably not all that efficient, but on a couple of occasions already, it stopped us from making a few mistakes and prevented us from involving people who shouldn't be involved. With the NF, nobody just walks in the door. The Northwest Front is a legal political movement, but we are forced by the conditions of our time and by the intolerant and persecutorial nature of the United States government and society to act as if we were an illegal one. We are in the process of building proper cells, small groups of people who operate almost independently, and who in essence get together secretly and conspire to commit perfectly lawful acts, because we are exercising our constitutional rights in a way that the United States government doesn't want them exercised. To finally answer your question, Hewitt, this pretty much rules out the big annual meeting. I think you'll all agree it's time for a music break. A female comrade emailed me and asked if I take requests, and so long as it's nothing by Bob Marley or the soundtrack from Fiddler on the Roof, yes, I do. So for all you mystics out there, this is Pale Shelter by Heretic. Thank you. Okay, guys, I did it again. I allowed the question time to degenerate into a rant, but what can I tell you? When I get going, I'm harder to shut up than Grandpa Simpson. I'll try to get back on track here. Chris from Detroit asks, Dear Mr. Covington, can you discuss the symbiotic relationship between blacks and Jews and how they, in tandem, always destroy white civilization? Well, actually, Chris, that admittedly destructive symbiosis is fairly new. It came into being over the past 100 years or so, along with the so-called civil rights movement and this pernicious and ridiculous idea that Negroids are in some way equal to whites, which is palpably and demonstrably absurd, but then in politically correct America, we're like Alice in Wonderland and we're required to believe 6 impossible things before breakfast. I'll answer your question as best I can, but this is going to take a little historic digression of the kind I've become famous for, or possibly infamous for. This will sound like I'm rambling again, but bear with me, I assure you there is a point to it all. Just may take me a while to get into it. To make a long and complex story as short as I can, when the Jews first came to this country, beginning in the colonial period, they were able to use the free enterprise system to make more money than even they had ever had in their long history, notably through such things as the slave trade, through financially carpetbagging the South during Reconstruction, for financially bankrolling the New England textile mills and the coal mines where 10-year-old children worked 14 hours a day, that kind of thing. We read about Gentile millionaires like Carnegie and Pullman and Vanderbilt and J.P. Morgan, and let me make it clear that those men were no saints, not by a long shot. But while Gentile robber barons tended to be involved in manufacturing, i.e. actually making or producing something like railroads or steel or heavy industry, the Jews mostly stuck with businesses where money and paper produced more money, like banking and the stock exchange. The wealthy Jews were always there in the background, like Bernard Baruch, like the various American Rothschild branches, Jay Gould, who tried to corner the gold market and brought about the crash of 1868, so forth and so on. Most of these big Jew banking and stockbroking firms that exist today, like Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, Kuhn Loeb, and so on, were established in the late 19th or early 20th centuries. By the early part of the 20th century, the Jewish community in this country, on the whole, was pretty wealthy, and they started looking for some way to translate their money and power into actual political power to assume what they believed to be their God-ordained right to rule the rest of humanity. They couldn't do it in the old American way by running for office because America was still a Christian country in those days, and also because our ancestors weren't as brain-dead as white people are today, and most of them understood what the Jews were all about. However, what the Kikes did have going for them was, among other things, an immense leap forward in communications technology. In Europe and also in this country, they gravitated towards the traditional newspaper business, like flies to honey, and hence newspaper barons who were Jews, like Adolf Ox and Joseph Pulitzer. But then electronic media, such as radio and above all cinema, came along, and the Jews realized that they could use this new technology as a weapon to undermine traditional white Christian values and prepare the way for the takeover of political power in America that eventually occurred. The Jews recognized the power of film, and they were in on the Hollywood scene from the very beginning. Indeed, there's actually a book by a man called Neil Gabler called An Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Created Hollywood. You can Google it and order it if you're interested in learning about that aspect of their history. Through Hollywood and through Hollywood's bastard progeny television, the Jews began to mold opinion and change the way white Americans think, with a view towards making white people hate themselves and hate the civilization they'd created, hate the religion and the values of their forefathers. I mean, you all get the idea, and you know how successful the Kikes have been in accomplishing that. Now, it wouldn't be accurate to say that liberalism as we know it is completely Jewish in origin. As much as I hate to say it, that little aberration was originally ours. It all started with an idiot named Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who was morally responsible for the hideous slaughter of the French Revolution, but I won't go that far back. Modern liberalism in America has its roots in two movements, both centered in New England in the early and mid-19th century, those movements being abolitionism and temperance, or prohibitionism. Basically, the right of a wise liberal elite who, of course, knows so much better than the rest of us how we should live our lives to tell us what to do. In the one case, we're not supposed to keep slaves and, you know, treat the poor little niggers badly and all that sort of thing. In the other, we're not supposed to drink because, you know, that makes the factory hands show up drunk for work and damage the machinery, that sort of stuff. Although most of the Active proponents of both prohibition and abolition were early feminist types, a bunch of hairy-legged Yankee women like Harriet Beecher Stowe and Susan B. Anthony. Both of these movements were very consciously created by Yankee merchant prince types such as the Cabots and Lodges in Boston, and support of New England buccaneer capitalism and big business, which was just getting started in those days, and some remnants of which persist even to this day in the form of what's referred to as old money or old wasp money or Boston Brahmin money or whatever, your basic Newport set, although I know most of you won't get that reference. Okay, to show I haven't totally lost track of Chris's question, this is where race starts to come in. In those days, the New England textile manufacturers wanted access to Southern cotton at incredibly cheap prices, and they didn't like the Southern plantation system, which was based on slave labor, and which meant that they had to deal with a small clique of wealthy and educated Southern planters who were quite capable of defending their own interests and making sure that they got a decent price for Southern cotton and corn and tobacco, or at any rate, more than the New England textile operators wanted to pay. The Yankees also didn't want the South shipping their cotton abroad to the mills in England and France. They wanted it all for themselves, which is why they started strangling the South economically in the 1830s through export tariffs, so forth and so on. And don't worry, I won't get into that. What the New England business interests wanted, and what they eventually got through the Civil War and the slaughter of something like 700,000 white Americans on both sides, was to impose the sharecropper system on the South, wherein they no longer had to deal with a small group of educated and able white men of their own class, but instead they bought their cotton from tens of thousands of small farmers who used sharecropped labor and who pretty much had to take what the cotton factor offered, because the South was divided up into territories and that one factor was the only game in town. Needless to say, most cotton factors were Jews. They bought the cotton and the tobacco, and they owned the warehouses and handled the shipping arrangements by rail or riverboat to send the bales of cotton north to the mills. But in order to impose this kind of economic system on the South, all racial differences needed to be eliminated between black and white labor. The Jew was attempting to do what he always does best, reduce the goyim to single interchangeable units of economic production and consumption, leveled down to the lowest common denominator, i.e. the Negro level. And if it hadn't been for the Ku Klux Klan and the remnants of the educated white male political elite in the South after the war, the Confederate veterans, they would have succeeded. They didn't, because the South engaged in active resistance, some of it armed resistance, making it unprofitable for the Northern establishment to continue Reconstruction and establishing legal segregation, and that held the racial line for another 80 years or so until 1953 and Brown versus Education came along, etc., etc. But during the Reconstruction, the Jews had discovered the usefulness of the Negro as a weapon against the white Christian establishment. He figured out how to ally himself with the liberals of the time, the abolitionists and so forth, and behind them the New England capitalists, in whose economic interests it was to eliminate all racial differences to ensure a pool of cheap non-union labor. Now, this is somewhat similar to what's going on today, with capitalism bringing in the Mexicans by the millions. A quick cliff note here. The story of capitalism consists very largely of a never-ending search for cheap labor, because the equation of capitalism is that cheap labor plus cheap raw materials equals profit. Capitalists don't care at all what color their labor is, nor do they care anything at all about the living conditions or the quality of life for their workers. To them, labor is a commodity to be bought and sold like anything else. To the rich men in suits who run this country to this day, you and your family are nothing but a commodity to be bought and sold and thrown away when you're worn out, like an empty beer can, and we're seeing this right now in the Obama Depression. Now, quick pop quiz on our recent history lesson. How did the South end Reconstruction and manage to establish a fairly stable and viable white-controlled society for almost 80 years? They used active resistance, including but not restricted to armed struggle, in order to make the continuation of Reconstruction unprofitable to the wealthy men in suits, both Jewish and Gentile, who ran America at the time. This is how we persuade the people in power to stop what they're doing and change their behavior. We make it unprofitable for them to continue what they're doing, in the sense that the financial and personal risk to them does not justify the possible profit of continuing in their behavior. That's how it's done, people. That's the only way it can be done. I know this sounds like I have wandered 10 miles from Chris's question, but do you see what I'm driving at here? Blacks and Mexicans and public perversion and all that, these people and things are just some among many tools of the Jew in order to destroy a society which prevents him from ruling others as he believes he has been appointed by God to do. The black problem is simply the most visible of these tools. Although, of course, living in Detroit, Chris, that's the one you see most every day. There really is no black problem, no Mexican problem, no faggot problem, no Federal Reserve problem, no gun control problem. None of these issues that most of us obsess about really exist in themselves. They are only symptoms of the disease. And to cure a disease, you don't treat the symptom, you strike at the germ itself. White people have a very bad habit of getting involved in one-issue politics, and we have to start looking at the big picture here. There are only two real problems in human society, the Jewish problem and the white character problem. The Jewish problem is what the Jews do, and the white character problem is why white men let them do it. Everything else is merely a symptom. These two central issues are the disease. Okay, enough. Time for another music break. Back about 6 weeks ago, when I was sending out sample theme songs for this show to people for their comments and approval, I sent out a song by the Dubliners called Oroshe de Bathavalia, which is an old Jacobite song in Irish Gaelic, and some of you emailed me back and said, "Nice song, but what the hell is that? I can't understand any of it." I've noticed that a lot of white people claim Irish, Scottish, Celtic, or Celtic ancestry. I've always said Celtic myself, but no one seems to be quite sure how the word should be pronounced. And they even go so far as to tattoo Celtic crosses on themselves and use it on their literature and so forth, and yet most of us seem to have no idea at all what it actually means. Most of you have never been to Scotland or Ireland, and while you may be academically aware that Gaelic is the oldest surviving Aryan language that's still spoken anywhere today, most of you have no idea what it even sounds like. Well, this is it.
Ve gresh ve hen ye hen the new ve bra the shall of my luck to dear palash the call over all she have well ya over all she have well ya over all she have well ya hanisha hatan hauri tagger on your way lettery hasar ya They grew it out all. Oh, Roche, well, yeah. Oh, Roche, well, yeah. Oh, Roche, well, yeah. Hanisha, Hatton, Tauri. Have we the rain of a girl that can be your pure ignorant shots in the gun you wear? This meal of gosh. Thank you.
Okay, this is the part of the broadcast where I try to wing it and all the uhs and ers and ahs start kicking in. My voice is sounding pretty gravelly, but it's functioning. The comrade who has offered to try and do the editing for this podcast urges me not to go off on the cuff like this, because then I really start to ramble and he's going to have to edit out all the e's and uhs and does. Anyway, I'd like to ask him not to bother. Let's just see how I do. I have to refurbish my dialectic and presentation skills here. I can't be like Obama and rely completely on a teleprompter, or in my case, written talking points. Sooner or later, I'm going to have to relearn how to think and speak on my feet. I used to be pretty good at that sort of thing, media interviews and so on, but I've gotten real rusty and I need the practice. Now, since the first part of the show, rather against my original intention, developed into more monologue than question time, I'll try to ad-lib a question here, which I didn't get to in the first part of the show. This is from Jason in Vancouver, and he writes, "Since the topic of our economy seems to be on everyone's mind, I would like to suggest how we as white nationalists would tackle this problem. Things such as more manufacturing exports and less imports, credit and retail. Maybe some sort of labor front organization that would take care of infrastructure like roads, railways, and farming, so we don't have to rely on third worlders and tax increases to pay for upkeep. In return, these employees would actually have some type of tax-exempt status because of the services they would provide to the nation. Thereby, they would be able to keep more of their hard-earned money to be able to spend back into and help jumpstart the economy again. Obviously, this also leads to more employment and boost of morale. Just a thought." Okay, Jason. This is going to be a difficult topic for me to ad lib on, but I'll try. Now, the fact is that after independence, however it's achieved, we have to assume that the Northwest Republic will be facing an extremely hostile world. What kind of shape the global markets and the global economy will be in as a whole, we have no idea. I would imagine that as part of the overall collapse, the world banking system, the International Monetary Fund, and so forth, would probably be in not so good of a shape. There will be problems supplying manufactured goods and even basic things like food and energy. What the Northwest Republic will have to do in that event is two-pronged. The first challenge we'll face is to create a virtually self-sustaining economy, by which I mean a manufacturing and distribution infrastructure that makes certain that the citizens and residents of the Northwest Republic have the basic necessities of life to begin with, i.e. food, shelter, transportation, and enough energy to stay warm in winter, one way or the other. Getting back to Hewitt's question earlier, this is another argument against enclaves. We will require a large enough territory with sufficient resources to produce what we need. The second challenge we'll have to face is to overcome the inevitable economic sanctions which the rest of the world will attempt to impose on us. I have some advantage there over the rest of you in that I lived in Rhodesia in the 1970s and I was able to observe how it's done. Energy will be a problem. We do have a few oil and natural gas wells here in the homeland, but not many. We'll have to produce very serious alternative sources from anything that we can possibly think up, be it, you know, windmills, whatever. Especially, we'll have to begin very serious development of non-petroleum-based energy sources, most likely ethanol and methane, and that will mean massive chicken and pig farming enterprises, so get used to hearing a lot of cluck, 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 and oink, oink, oink around the Northwest Republic, because it's going to take a lot of chicken droppings and a lot of pig shit to extract the methane and the phosphates that we're going to need. And one of the big objections that the oil companies have come up with against ethanol and methane as fuel is that to convert a huge industrialized society like the United States to these alternate fuels would be too expensive and complicated a process. And they're right about that as far as the whole USA goes. But we won't be trying to convert the whole USA, just a few Northwest states and whatever bits and pieces of Montana or British Columbia we can glum onto, and our energy consumption will be anywhere near what it is for the whole USA. We can also cut it further through such things as revitalized rail networks and public transportation. You'd be surprised how many white people will be willing to use public transportation as long as they're not forced into contact with dangerous and repulsive minorities on the buses and trains. As far as ethanol goes, yes, you can make ethanol out of corn, basically white lightning like moonshiners back in the Appalachians still make, but although I'm not sure of the exact chemistry, I'm sure that ethanol can also be made out of grain, fruit, potatoes, which Idaho's got plenty of, or just plain raw sugar, which we can process from sugar beets, which we also have a lot of. We can actually grow and produce our own energy sources, not have to rely on finding it hidden under the ground someplace. Remember, we're not trying to produce single malt for drinking. We're producing an industrial alcohol for fuel. We will have to create our own industrial capacity to produce the heavy stuff that we need, steel, concrete, plastics, metal refining and production of all kinds, and that will be a major challenge which will occupy our new nation for the first few decades of our existence. As far as employment goes, I honestly don't think we'll have that much problem with it because there will be so much to do in building a new country in some areas, almost from the ground up, that we will actually, in my opinion, suffer a labor shortage in at least the few years, well, the first few years of the Republic's existence, and we will have to make a major effort to attract skilled white immigrants from all over the globe to help us meet that shortage. You may recall that in my novel, The Hill of the Ravens, which is actually set in the future Northwest American Republic, I make reference to the National Labor Service, which, I confess, is straight out of Adolf Hitler's playbook in the Third Reich. The idea is that the state has a duty to make sure that its citizens don't starve or freeze to death, but you don't do that by giving them money like they were welfare niggers, because that creates a welfare dependency even in whites, as I saw myself in Britain and Ireland, which are left-wing socialist welfare states. A sane and sensible state performs that duty to its citizens by giving them jobs, maybe not the greatest and most fulfilling jobs in the world, but doing all the things that have to be done in order to sustain a civilized and technological society. Just bear in mind, whatever you may think of National Socialism, what Hitler did for the Third Reich worked in pulling Germany out of the Great Depression. So we do have a model or a blueprint on how to go about this. As far as housing goes, we won't be short of that either, because we'll have a surplus of housing available, which has been left behind by all the liberals and minorities and red, white, and blue jackasses who flee from the Republic after the Revolution. Just like Israel gave the Palestinians houses to Jewish immigrants after the Palestinians fled in 1948, we will give the homes of those who don't want to live in a sovereign white nation to those who do. Some people ask me if I ever intend to write another Northwest novel. Probably not. But if I ever do, it will be a book that starts where The Brigade and a Mighty Fortress left off, on October 22nd, the day that the tricolor flag first goes up over Longview. And it will follow the first 50 years or so of the Northwest Republic's existence through the eyes of several families, one nationalist, one former unionist, one sort of mushy American Joe six-pack type, as they and their children go through all the changes and the events in the young Northwest nation's life. One of the reasons I probably won't write that book is that it would give my own vision of the NAR's future, not just speculation on what might happen to the country, but on how such a thing as a racially conscious white society should develop. And the fact is that my vision of that future might not be someone else's. Given our propensity to squabble among ourselves over obscure and irrelevant ideological issues as an excuse to continue talking and not acting, I don't want a situation to develop where we are going at one another hammer and tongs over all these details of a country that doesn't even exist yet. Now, remember the old recipe for how to make rabbit stew? It begins, first, catch your rabbit. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. The program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4586, Seattle, Washington, 98104, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Andenbaum, Freedom. For the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be.